Welcome to the LSE Events Podcast by the London School of Economics and Political Science. Get ready to hear from some of the most influential international figures in the social sciences.
Welcome, everyone. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the LSE today for this evening's hybrid event, which forms part of the LSE Festival, which has a theme this year, Power and Politics. The festival is taking place from yesterday, Monday the 10th, to Saturday the 15th of June, and explores how power and politics shapes our world. My name is Bart Kamarts. I am Professor of Politics and Communication here at the LSE, and also Head of Department of the Media and Communication Department, also here at LSE. I'm very pleased here to welcome Dr. Kate Wright, Alan Rusbridger, and Dr. Damien Tambini. Kate Wright is Associate Professor in Media and Communications at the School of Social and Political Science at the University of Edinburgh. She studies how international news journalists negotiate tensions between their normative values and the changing political, economic, and technological factors that all shaped their work. Her books include Who's Reporting Africa Now?, Humanitarian Journalists, and her most recent one, Capturing News, Capturing Democracy, Trump and the Voice of America, on which she will speak in a minute. Alan Rusbridger is editor of Prospect magazine and chair of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, having been editor-in-chief of The Guardian from 1995 till 2015. Until 2021, he was principal of Lady Margaret Hall, Oxford. During his time at The Guardian, Alan and the paper won numerous awards, including the 2014 Pulitzer Prize for Public Service Journalism, and his most recent books are Breaking News and News and How to Use It. Finally, Damien Tambini is a distinguished policy fellow in the Department of Media and Communications at the LSE. He is currently visiting professor at the universities of Cologne in Essen in Germany, and in 2023 was visiting professor in public policy at the CEU in Vienna. His last three books had the titles Media Freedom, subsequently Regulating Big Tech, and Digital Dominance. He advises the European Commission and the Council of Europe on media policy. Today we will be exploring the disconcerting dynamic between authoritarian populism and public service media. From the politicization of public service media, beginning with the Trump's presidency in the US and Boris Johnson's government in the UK, to the unremitting threats of democratic backsliding that's facing journalism and journalists today. For those of you who use X in the audience, the hashtag for today's event is hashtag LSE Festival. I would also like to ask you to please put your phones on silent so as not to disrupt the event. The event is being recorded and will hopefully be made available as a podcast. As usual, there will be the chance for you to put questions to our speakers, and for our online audience, you can submit your questions via the Q&A feature. Please include your name and affiliation. For those of you here in the theater, I will let you know when we will open the floor for questions, and please raise your hand and wait for stewards with a roving microphone to come to you, and also let us know your name and affiliation. So thank you, and before, without further ado, I would like to invite Kate to do a presentation. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Bart. Thank you, it's great to be here. Who here has read the document which contains the vision for the next Trump administration? That's the report by Project 2025. Just give me a little wave. Who's actually read it? Ooh, impressive people at LSE. For people who are concerned about media freedom, it's really important. You don't just read the reports about it, but you sit down and read the entire report. There is a whole chapter in there about the US Agency for Global Media and why that should be answerable to the US president. Now that's important because the US Agency for Global Media is the home of all US-funded international media. There are several organizations. And it is part of an independent federal agency. That means it is very much not meant to be answerable to the president. There is no recognition in that chapter of the independence of that agency and its purpose in protecting journalistic freedom. Now, I'm here because I am sincerely and genuinely worried that in the event of another Trump administration, we could be looking at the very rapid politicization of those media networks and potentially even attempts to turn them into state media. Of course, I'm planting a new book. I'm sorry, all academics do this. When a Trump appointee last led the US Agency for Global Media, that was during 2020, so during the last Trump administration, we found, myself, Martin Scott, and Mel Bunce, that politicization happened very quickly indeed. That is not to say that at that stage there was necessarily a clear plan for that to happen. The last Trump administration was much more ad hoc or chaotic than what we're seeing now. Nevertheless, in this book, which is coming out shortly with Oxford University Press, we use rare interviews with Voice of America journalists and managers, as well as internal correspondence and declassified documents obtained from five different Freedom of Information archives to prove that during the last 7 months of the Trump administration, politicization took place at breakneck speed. Now, I mentioned the Voice of America. A lot of people in the UK don't know what that is, so just give me a moment to explain that. The Voice of America is the oldest and largest US-funded international media network. Sometimes it's described as an overseas broadcaster, but that's not really true. It's been producing broadcast, online, and social media for many years now in 48 languages. And it's got an international audience of over 326 million. US citizens can, of course, consume VOA content online or on social media. It would be impossible to ban that. But VOA is banned from targeting US citizens by law, a law called the Smith-Mundt Act. One of the things that troubled us is that we found that if there was a future government with authoritarian leanings, whether that is a future Trump administration or something else, if that government was willing to break the law in principle, there would be nothing really to stop it practically from capturing networks like Voice of America and using them to spread international propaganda or even target US citizens. The laws that are meant to prevent this have no teeth. In fact, one respondent who asked to be remain anonymous worked it out that in terms of what would need to happen technically and in terms of legal rebroadcast permits, it would take weeks, not months, to turn the Voice of America into a major US media organization. So why was this? I'm showing you now a picture of how the agency regards the protection of journalistic freedom. And you'll notice it's a binary system. You've got editorial matters on the one hand, internet, radio, television. You've got a firewall in the middle that's composed by legislation, particularly the International Broadcasting Act of 1994. And you've got everything else on the other side. And in a nutshell, we see two problems with this. Number one, the laws that are meant to construct the firewall are outdated. 1994 was a long time ago now, pre-online media, pre the rise of social media. They're also extremely vaguely worded. They were worded so vaguely that when a court case was brought against the political appointees who oversaw this politicization, the judge ruled that she couldn't possibly use this law to pass a verdict because it was so imprecise it was unusable in a practical sense. The second problem is that, as I'm sure my colleagues will go on to expand upon, many of the forms of government capture start on the unprotected side of the wall. They start with taking over the governance body. Governance bodies and governance processes, as I'm sure Alan and Damien will go on to explain, are incredibly important. They start with the politicization and the control of funding, and in this case, human resources. And they start with a particularly toxic form of populist media discourse, which starts to use journalists' statutory obligations against them. That is to say, it weaponizes them. Consistent allegations that a network is biased politically. But those allegations only come from one political direction. Suggestions that journalists maybe just aren't patriotic enough. They're too critical. They run the country down rather than boosting it up. And there are, in America's cases, suggestions that VOA is a security risk. There might be foreign spies inside of it, which is why greater government control is needed. And again, a purely US context, there are suggestions that journalists are working against the government with the deep state. So although we might be sort of smiling about this here in the UK, this is very much not funny in the US. And we found that the combination of these factors changed journalists' working conditions. They were stressed. They didn't have the resources they needed to do their jobs properly. They felt they were constantly under attack, constantly being criticised. They were worried about whether their contracts could be renewed because there was no money. And foreign journalists were worried that they would lose their right to remain because visas were not being renewed. In these circumstances, it's extremely difficult to resist editorial interventions, particularly when these come in the guise of internal disciplinary processes about balance or bias. So although we found some extremely impressive examples of journalists and managers resisting what was by the end overt politicization, many journalists started self-censoring very, very quickly. Remember, we're talking about 7 months here, very quickly and in very extreme ways. So we have come to the conclusion that this traditional idea of a firewall, it just doesn't work. It's not an effective defense against a government with authoritarian tendencies. As one of our respondents put it, it's paper thin. We are left waving a piece of paper that says we have a firewall on it, but everyone knows now it's not true.
Thank you so much. Alan?
Well, I think I'm here because I wrote an article earlier this year about what I call the government capture of the BBC. And this is how it worked. In 2004, I don't think anybody had heard of a man called Dominic Cummings. He ran an obscure blog. But on that blog in 2004, there was this sentence: there are three structural things that the right needs to happen in terms of communications. Number one, the undermining of the BBC's credibility. Number two, the creation of a Fox News equivalent, stroke talk shows, stroke bloggers, etc., to shift the centre of gravity. And number three, the end of a ban on TV political advertising. So that was 2004. 15 years later, Dominic Cummings was in the heart of government at Number 10 Downing Street. Boris Johnson was the Prime Minister. And I think we saw a deliberate attempt to put that programme into action. What happened was that between them, Johnson and Cummings tried to capture both the BBC and the regulator of the BBC. There was a very clumsy attempt by Johnson to pre-announce the people that he wanted to be running the BBC and Ofcom. So he wanted two Tory editors to go into those jobs. That in the end didn't happen. One of them, because he failed the interview process, it was deemed unacceptable, and one of them withdrew. But it showed the intent of what the government was trying to do. And instead, the person who went in to run the BBC was a major Tory donor. That didn't end well. And the appointment of the regulator, Ofcom, was, I think we can use the word, corrupted. So for that job, there ended up a shortlist of two people, with this highly important, quite technical job of regulating all broadband, telecoms, and communications, as well as the public service broadcaster. So there were two, a short list of two, and they were both Conservative peers, by remarkable coincidence. And what happened then, and this is how I came to write this piece, was described in continual laughter in Nadine Dorris's book, The Plot. And whatever you think of Nadine Dorris and whatever you think of that book, there was a story there about how they somebody within Number 10, she later named him as a man called Dougie Smith, tried to persuade her as Secretary of State for Culture to choose one Tory peer over the other. They wanted somebody who'd been working inside the Tory central office for 20 years to be the director. And she ignored them. She was then nobbled twice more. And then she says, in the middle of the night, the advice that she had put into Johnson to appoint Lord Grade was switched by this man, Dougie Smith, to go for the other Tory peer. So, I mean, I think that we can agree that's sort of out-and-out corruption and an attempt really to implement the Cummings blueprint. So we came very, very close, but for the act of a whistleblower within Number 10, to Johnson succeeding in putting the people he wanted into Number 10, into the BBC and into the regulator. And that would have had been an extraordinary moment of capture. The second thing that Cummings did, you remember, was to create a Fox News alternative. And I think that's happened. GB News is clearly positioning itself as a Fox News alternative, as a sort of shock jock attempt to move public service broadcasting, because it is regulated by Ofcom, markedly to the right. And all that's been funded by Paul Marshall, who I think has a building here named after him. Who incidentally wants to get his hands on the Daily Telegraph. So you see a sort of little mini Murdoch in the making of somebody who owns an opinionated newspaper, an opinionated news channel. And of course, all this depends on Ofcom allowing that to happen. And then you think, but they've fixed Ofcom in order to give the lightest possibly regulatory touch. Then you get the undermining of the credibility of the BBC, and you've touched on that. And that happens on a daily basis by a commercial press that is ideologically and commercially and viscerally opposed to the very existence of the BBC. And suddenly you've got a very dangerous situation. This is all the more stoked up in the context of UK because you have this particular press ownership environment, which is mainly in the hands of billionaires. We call them press barons because of them. Some of them literally become press barons. The baronessy is there if they wanted it. It doesn't matter if you're the son of a KGB officer. You can come in, you can own the newspapers, and you will get the baronessy at the end of it. Lord Lebedev of Richmond and Siberia, most unusual title. And then, of course, at the peak of that, you've got Rupert Murdoch, who, again, as detailed in The Guardian and Prospect, was running essentially a criminal enterprise for many years and has got deep enough pockets. It's cost him about £1 billion to bail himself out of this. But he can be reliable, his organs can be reliably depended upon to undermine this business of credibility in exactly the way that we've heard already. So, look, Britain is not Hungary, it's not Poland, it's not Turkey. But some of these patterns are beginning to happen. We might talk later about Brexit and how the populist press allied itself with a populist government to deliver the same objective, and how destructive that was, I think, to the craft of journalism and the authority of journalism and the trust in journalism. This couldn't happen at a more dangerous time for the press because of all the things that we understand about the economic viability of the press and the trust in press. So it's a very dangerous time for journalism. And that, to me, is why the BBC and public service broadcasting is so important as part of the mix. And it seems to me absolutely vital that we fight for a form of the BBC, whatever that looks like, however it's funded. It has to be protected, insulated in ways that that are currently quite unsatisfactory from the interference from government. And I just hope that the Labour government, if we're to have a Labour government that looks like we are, understands how crucial the BBC is and how to strengthen it and insulate it from this really alarming attempt to really destroy its trust and capture it that I described in that Prospect article.
Thank you so much. A final speaker, Dr. Damien Tantini.
Thank you, Bart. Before I add to our doom, I want to just mention one of the people who I think would be very much part of this discussion and support this discussion were he here, and that is the former director of Reporters Without Borders, who tragically died very young. We are on Saturday. So I was privileged to work with Christophe Deloire in recent years, a very much a freedom fighter. And we're privileged to have a number of international charities, campaigns, NGOs that work in the area of media freedom. Many of which are headquartered here in the UK. So I take some inspiration from Christophe that we will resolve some of these problems, and that there is a role for academic research in the very practical task of coming up with solutions. So I want to just pick up on what's been said already by just trying to crystallise why we're having what seems to be a worldwide pattern of capture of both international and national public service media, and what to do about it as well. So it's not really a coincidence, I don't think, that we see an intensification of what we've discussed here as media capture in recent years, and that public service media are particularly vulnerable. So the toolkit of media capture is quite clear. It's quite clear from Kate's book. Appointments to the board, appointments to the regulator, money, control of funding, packing the regulator, and general meddling through having people appointed within public service media. That's the pattern in all of those cases that we've discussed today, and it certainly is a pattern which is developing in the BBC. But why is this intensifying now? And I think we need to see this in terms of some quite intense changes which are happening in the media sector at the moment. It's not just about populism, it's also about polarisation. So if you've been to as many BBC conferences as I've been to, very often they will say, well, the BBC is very trusted, and yes, it's true that some people see the BBC as biased, but they exactly the same number of people, a proportion of people, see them as biased to the left as see them as biased to the right. But the problem in a polarising environment, and we're having this breakup of the kind of post-war consensus, is that more people think the BBC is more biased, both on the left and on the right. So that the overall level of trust in public service media is breaking down, and that is being exploited by the populists. This is related also to structural problems in the media. So there's a weakness in the business model. This makes public service media very vulnerable, partly because the BBC and other public service media are always asking the government for something. So whether it's access to new distribution after digital switchover, whether it's permission to launch new services, there is a much more reciprocity or potential for reciprocity in that relationship. There is also, and Dominic Cummings I think is an obvious culprit here, very clearly a lack of executive restraint. A lot of what managed that relationship between the government and public service media was simply the government saying, we will not interfere. There are standards here. These were not written, they were not necessarily in the charter or in the law, but they were really about a culture. And also on the side of journalists, professional values. So professional values which are, and we saw that very loud and clear in relation to Richard Sharp, for example, and the Lineker episode when he had full support of all of the BBC's journalists when his independence came under fire. So there is there are a number of structural reasons why this is happening now. But to cut to the chase, what to do about it? But before I say what to do about it, I think one thing I think I would pick Kate up on is there's a danger sometimes that we might see this in a slightly one-sided way. So this is not a balanced panel. This is not a politically balanced panel by any stretch of the imagination. I'm sure this is not a politically balanced audience. The BBC is, as I mentioned, getting it in the neck, both from the right and from the left. And indeed, there are instances around the world where public service media do become, have the potential to become, slightly corrupt organisations providing regime jobs. You know, we have to face the complexities in all of these discussions. It's really not a one-sided problem. But the key point in when we deal with this is that we don't fall into the trap of making the same mistakes again. So if there is a change of government in this country, I would very much hope a future government does not see this as a signal to pack their people into the regulator and their people into the upper echelons of the BBC. What to do about it has to be based on long-term trust in these organisations, and it has to be much more selfless on the part of the politicians. So journalists, as I mentioned, and professional values are part of the solution, but journalists need laws. Kate's model suggests that the firewall is not working. There are models, and I'd look to the European Union, in fact, for an example of something which has been done where quite early on in something called the Democracy Action Plan, the EU identified this as a threat to democracy in the European Union. And just last month, the European Media Freedom Act came into force. And this is a deliberate attempt to identify the ways in which, specifically in Hungary and Poland, the media freedom has been undermined, and particularly freedom of public service media. And if you look at, and you can go ahead and look it up right now if you like, Article 5 of the European Media Freedom Act contains legal protections for European public service media. So what is better than a law to protect public service media is a law in which you can take your government to a court outside of the jurisdiction because the treaty basis exists and you've signed up to that kind of discipline. So the UK, of course, is not in the European Union anymore, so we don't have the benefit of that protection. But we are still a member of the European Convention on Human Rights, and the Council of Europe still has a number of standards and legal protections of public service media independence, which have been used to protect public service media and can be used in the future. But I think there are things that a government that genuinely wanted to protect independence of public service media and therefore democracy could do. They could have domestic laws to protect the BBC's independence, for example. That could be written into the charter. That could be something that journalists could protect, use in the courts to protect the independence of the BBC. So I mean, I think we saw in Kate's wonderful research, and I do recommend the book which I read today, we can see that the legal frameworks are out of date. They can be updated. Things can be done with the existing law domestically and internationally. But I would say on behalf of the Academy that we also, you know, there's lots of practice, but you also need some theory. We are going through a huge period of change in relation to what the state is, what the government is. It's being mediatized. The boundary between the state and the independent media is not well understood, and we have very weak theory in political theory, in media theory, and in constitutional law relation to the boundaries between the state and the media. So that's a pitch from me on my next book.
Thank you so much.
Hi, I'm interrupting this event to tell you about another awesome LSE podcast that we think you'd enjoy. LSE IQ asks social scientists and other experts to answer one intelligent question, like, why do people believe in conspiracy theories? Or, can we afford the super rich? Come check us out. Just search for LSE IQ wherever you get your podcasts. Now, back to the event.
Thanks for the presentations and contributions to the debate, and I'm happy to kind of open things up for questions from all of you, both online and here in the room. And we'll, if you kind of can hold up your hand if you have a question, and we can kind of bring some roving mics, and then if you can say your name and your affiliation, and I will kind of alternate a little bit between in the room and online. Let's start there.
Thank you. James Knight, Member of Public. I just wonder if you could say something about the situation in Scotland. We have a different media from in England, actually, and BBC is supposed to be BBC Scotland. I'm not sure where the connections with the rest of the BBC is. I just wonder if you could say something about Scotland at all. Thank you.
Tricky one, having worked for BBC Scotland, and also the Today programme, where yes, the Blair spin doctors were no nicer than the Conservative ones. It's a tricky one. I think Scottish media, as a scene, is dramatically underfunded. So BBC Scotland appears much more important proportionally than it would do if there was a thriving print scene. I think even the very good broadsheets are struggling at the moment. What I am sad to see, I'll put it that way, start to fade away is some of the enthusiasm for grassroots media in Scotland that was there when I first started reporting on what was then the new Scottish Parliament. So that gives you an idea that I'm no spring chicken. And what I did then, I had a wonderful experience. We had a converted camper van, and we went off with Leslie Ruddock, who you may well know, on a call-in show right the way around Scotland. And it was modelled on the public sphere, quite deliberately. And politics is taught within Scottish schools, and the quality of debate and call-ins is often quite high. So I had the wonderful experience of Mrs. Macready giving the First Minister, then Donald Dewar, a real run for his money. And I think that energy and that kind of appetite and that optimism about political dialogue is perhaps deeper, a deeper problem than just the situation with the BBC. The kind of the heart, the will to engage in that political dialogue, the assumption that it will make a positive difference, my reading is, that's kind of gone out of Scotland after the referendum. There is a feeling that post-Brexit in particular, we were lied to and nobody cares. So I think, I don't know if that's a rather roundabout way of answering your question. I think there is a deeper malaise in Scottish politics, which goes a little bit deeper than just the BBC's role or lack of it.
Hi, I'm Leonie. I'm a master's student at LSE. Given the emerging capabilities of artificial intelligence in generating content that can effectively camouflage as human-generated and evidence-based, what, in your opinion, is the future of the truth as a concept and of trust in media?
Wow. That's a big question. Who wants to go first?
I could say something on that, but let someone else start.
It's not just the very surface of new technologies making it easier and cheaper to make fake stuff that's convincing. It's also, and this is, I think, when it comes to kind of human autonomy and human freedom and power, the ability of algorithms to learn about us and to target us with messages that will be persuasive to us, and to monitor and track us in ways which do compromise our autonomy. So, you know, where to start with AI and these problems? The short answer is, I think, it makes it more important to have media that the public should give what Honora O'Neill called in her lectures many years ago, due trust. So it's not just that we should trust the media, but we should trust it in ways which are deserved. And that means a more participatory, open and transparent approach to things like media literacy. And that's, you know, everybody, bullshit bingo, everybody always mentions media literacy. But it what it means is that we should know why we trust media. And that is really about opening bodies like the BBC. This week, the latest issue of Political Quarterly, the journal, is all about the BBC and the future. And in it, I make a modest proposal for a system of citizens' juries and internal participation within public service media. And I can say a bit more about that if we have time. But on AI, we need to actually proactively do more, if you like, to foster the healthy crops rather than to deal with the weeds. You know, we're not going to get out of this problem by playing whack-a-mole with fake stuff. We need to build the media that people can trust and that people know why they trust it.
Anyone else?
Could I chip in for Alan?
Well, I agree with everything that Damien said. I think there's something like a crisis around the very word journalism. So the optimistic answer to your very good question is that in the end, people should gravitate towards the craft of journalism produced by, you know, great journalists. Let's hope that happens. But the trouble is that word journalism is such a sort of weak and baggy word to encompass many different kinds of ideas. So the Daily Mail is journalism and so is the BBC. But they're entirely different ideas of what journalism. Fox News, GB News are journalism and so is the New York Times. The Sun is journalism, so is the FT. And until we can have a really fundamental debate about what this craft is that we're asking people to respect, I think my optimistic view of what's going to happen won't happen. And, you know, on this theme, I touched on it lightly, but the failure of journalism over Brexit, I wasn't working in journalism at the time, I was in Oxford, but I knew what I wanted from journalism. I thought this is the most consequential decision that I, as a voter, will be ever asked, as a country we will ever be asked. And I want journalism to give me the facts, you know. Tell me the facts, and if you want to tell me what you think I should vote, that's fine, but that's a sort of secondary thing to the consequences of voting each way. And the British press did almost the opposite of that. Day after day after day, they began by telling you how you should vote, and they gave you one side of the answer. So it was a complete failure of journalism, because the papers had in some way allied themselves with popular politics in a way that made them forget about the craft of journalism. So my optimistic answer is, in an ideal world, there will be a gravitational pull to journalism that has been through the craft, which may be assisted by AI, and let's hope. But at the moment, I think there's such a failure of that craft and a failure to trust that craft that is rather an optimistic view.
What are the key structural reasons for the intensification in media capture in recent years? And the second question is, which current democratic country would you argue has the largest amount of restrictions on media freedom?
I mean, structural reasons I hinted at before. I mean, we can tie this to the economic weakness of the media and the breakdown of business model based on advertising. If you take the examples of Hungary and Poland, so in the 1990s, we had a huge influx of investment, mainly from Germany, very controversially at the time, but it supported good quality journalism in Hungarian and Poland, in Hungary and Poland during the transition to what was a fledgling democracy. With the crisis of the media, a lot of that investment just simply went away. So the media groups in Hungary consolidated. They became very close to the government, and there is an exchange of reciprocities with the government. So, for example, the vulnerability that the biggest advertiser is the government in Hungary, and there is a huge amount of cronyism between industrial interests and the government articulated through those media holdings. So I think it's all about the economic situation of the media, but it also, you know, this is very highly complex. It is tied to the huge transition in geopolitics that we're witnessing at the moment, the end of the Pax Americana, a world in which the unchallenged superpower is no longer a democracy.
Is there anything in the US specifically that kind of speaks to these kind of structural reasons for capture?
I think it's more than the US. I mean, within the US, there are US-specific reasons. With VOA, it's embedded in a federal agency, which I think is a problem, because your journalists are federal employees. And the firewall doesn't go around the organization. It goes around just editorial freedom. So all the support services for Voice of America are inside its governance body, which makes it very easy to capture. However, what the book says, and yes, I will keep banging on about it, thank you, Damien, for the punt, is that with public media globally, there are 7 cases that we looked at around the world to see if there's kind of a recipe book, if you like, for the government capture of public media, whether that's national or international. And we made a point of looking at capture by left-wing governments as well as right-wing governments to pick up on the point of political balance. And we found that there is a remarkably consistent recipe book for the capture of public media. It is, as Damien pointed out, the capture of governance bodies and processes, the capture of funding or other resources, including human resources, which can involve things like visas. It's this kind of media discourse that we were talking about that keeps coming back in different iterations around the world. And the last one that we haven't touched on, but I think might have a bearing on the BBC Charter, is that the public media that are most vulnerable to having their purpose sort of reframed by this media discourse are ones that have a very poorly understood role, or an ambivalent role, or a mixed role. And I think one of the reasons in which Voice of America was so vulnerable to this is because it does have quite a mixed history, and because its charter pulls it in three different ways at once. And so I think it's really important that in an age of social media and online media, we don't think of international media purely in terms of being overseas broadcasters. We've tended to think about the consequences of Voice of America in terms of public diplomacy only. But we can't do that anymore. Whatever goes out on online and social media comes back home too. It has profound political consequences. But what really surprised us was really how consistent that recipe book was. We looked at Japan, we looked at Turkey, we looked at South Africa, as well as some of the European cases, and that was consistent right the way across the board.
Yeah, thank you all very much. The name's Ewan Grant. I'm a former law enforcement intelligence analyst, and the reason I say that is I have to declare an interest. I'm regularly interviewed on GB News and Talk TV, generally around the Ukraine war. And I have been invited back, despite rolling back when I was interviewed by Nigel Farage on two occasions. They did invite me back, and I'm still doing the broadcast. My question particularly is the international clout and the co-production links and, to a certain extent, the co-reporting role of the BBC, particularly in the English-speaking world, but not just that. How much of a safeguard do you think that will be in safeguarding the independence of the BBC and preventing a point that Dr. Wright, I think, referred to of self-censorship? Thank you.
This gentleman here. Can we take the second question and then...
Adrian Farina, also LSE. The focus right now is on how the media, traditional media, is being captured. But related to the prior question, most people are consuming media and information through social media, other networks, and not structured media. So if you were to put that order of priority for policymakers, it would be to strengthen the regulation and the firewalls that you described on the traditional media, or to try to elevate the regulation on the distribution channels, which are the ones that, inadvertently or not, they are facilitating the distribution of news that are, again, either fake or with deep fakes or, again, that disinformation. So where would you put in order of priority for current or future governments? Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm going to cheat with the last question. And I'm going to say, doing something about social media, and I can say a little bit more about what, should be at exactly the same level of priority as strengthening independence of public service media in the way I've suggested. We don't need to choose. These need to be done as part of an overall process of media reform. Now, I've been looking into the kind of deep history of this recently, and it's very interesting to compare this period. A lot of democratic backsliding, concern about propaganda, concern about trust and truth, geopolitical change. It's very similar to the post-war period, 45 to 55. And a lot of your cases, you know, the first broadcasting acts in places like Japan and Germany, obviously, post-conflict situations. But the whole paradigm of living in a liberal democracy based on legitimacy of public consent and the threat that propaganda and media concentration offers to that mode of legitimacy, we need to go back and think about the big structures. And to do that, we need to look at public service media and social media. You know, we have a situation in which that trust that I was talking about before is being undermined. Why? If you have a private distribution of social media, you just think about X. You know, it's not the most important, but same goes for ByteDance or TikTok or any of the other major platforms. They are owned by private companies in foreign countries, usually. Very undermining of that basic trust. There are problems of monopoly and distribution. We don't have access to the algorithm. This is not a long-term way of sustaining trust in democracy. Post-war, we had a series of big royal commissions, big reviews. We need to think on that scale, I think. We've got interesting new legislation, Digital Services Act, online safety, but that's really just the beginning. On the co-production and intent of the BBC, I'm not sure I fully understand the question, but I do think I do see globally that there is a protection of independence in collaboration with other public service broadcasters around the world, and that is partly about actual projects together or investment. Some of the bodies that, like the European Broadcasting Union and some of the international public broadcaster bodies, they don't do a lot to distinguish between state broadcasters and public broadcast, independent public broadcasters. You get captured by the state, you don't get kicked out, for example. So there's very little of that kind of international control. But I think there is safety in numbers with public broadcasters.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much. I want to know, what do you think about the intersection of this threat that we're debating about and the complicity of some media with some populist movements? If you can talk about how this issue is also like tension, some journalistic values, as you were saying.
I can do a little bit. You're looking at me. I'm going to take the opportunity to big up a PhD student of mine. Do we have any PhD students in the room? A little bit? Nobody. Oh, your supervisors love you. By the time it gets to the point when your PhD students are teaching you, it is one of the biggest joys. And your question made me think of one of my PhD students, who's called Ricardo Ribeiro Ferreira. He's a Brazilian ex-journalist. And he's just about to submit his PhD and looking for a job, if anybody's in the room. I told you I would back him. And his PhD is looking at the complicity of Brazilian journalists in the de-democratization process that's happened under Bolsonaro. And he finds, in a nutshell, that precarity, concern about your job, was one of the biggest drivers of journalists knowingly adopting journalistic practices that they knew were unfair, that would tilt the electoral playing field one way or another. There was a minority of journalists who were looking for career advancement. But the major driving factor was precarity. And what seemed to happen, that if I can take the liberty of paraphrasing his work, because he's not here, that after a period of top-down instructions, which were sometimes quite soft in some media houses, sometimes very hard and directive in other houses, where it was clear that the house prefers a particular narrative frame, that after some time in a period of precarity, journalists started to absorb that, to internalize that. And so almost automatically, they produced narrative frames that they believed, on the basis of past evidence, that their managers would prefer. So the answer to your question, insofar as I can answer it from that instance, is that complicity comes from precarity, comes from job insecurity. People who are insecure and they think they're going to be unemployed next week are really easy to push around. There's a minority of people who will be doing it for career advancement or on a minority of occasions. But there's also this deeper phenomenon where if you've been subject to pressure for so long, it gets in your head. And I think that interested me especially because another fantastic PhD student, in fact the best PhD I've ever read, not one of my students, worked in SABC. So she worked in South African Broadcasting Corporation. And she was looking at the politicization of that network under Jacob Zuma. And she encountered something she found called anticipatory politicization, where journalists have been under pressure for so long and they're not in a stable position to fight back, And they start to anticipate and even more extremely produce the views that their seniors want. So there is some kind of process there, which is actually self-censorship isn't as accurate as it should be, because self-censorship tends to be about not doing something, right? And what we find in both the Brazilian and the South African cases is that journalists actively do something as well. So they engage in active processes, acts of commission, if you like, not just omission. So precarity, for some people, career advancement, and it gets inside your head, if I can put it that colloquially.
There's something a little troubling I find about that. It's something that I've thought about for a long time. It was when we got Boris involved. Boris was on the media all the time because he was funny, and the media picked up this funny character, so they kept promoting him and promoting him and promoting him. And the same thing with Trump. And if he hadn't have been on The Apprentice, so Trump was seen as silly and perhaps not very threatening at the beginning. And again, he was picked up by the media all the time. And it happens with Farage all the time. And there's part of me that thinks the media has colluded in maintaining these people and putting them in their positions. And I find that very troubling. And I see it with Farage again now. And I get very upset about this in the media.
Yeah, it's a bit of catch 22 in a way, because for journalists, I mean, there is this public figure who makes provocative claims and you play into their cards by reacting to it. Even if you're criticizing it, you're kind of amplifying these things. But at the same time, silencing them is also not really an option. So I don't know if there are other kind of...
I think an example, it's sort of parallel to what you're talking about, the TV debate last week in which every contribution had to be 45 seconds. So if that's how we're going to frame our politics, then we're going to get quite strange people in charge. So it sort of destroys the possibility of nuanced thought or complexity or depth. And you're going to have, it's going to reward people who are very good at speaking in prolonged sound bites. And Farage is very good at that. Johnson was very good at that. But as we know, it doesn't translate into being a good prime minister. But so I think that there's a point in what you're saying, that if that's how the media wants to frame the electoral discussion, then you're almost setting yourself up to find people who probably aren't going to be the kind of leaders that we want.
So thank you so much to our speakers. Our time is up for a fascinating discussion, which I hope you all enjoyed. There's going to be more exciting events in the LSE Festival to take a copy of the program. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you for listening. You can subscribe to the LSE Events podcast on your favorite podcast app and help other listeners discover us by leaving a review. Visit lse.ac.uk/events to find out what's on next. We hope you join us at another LSE event soon.